Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you have been with us for the last couple of sessions, you know we are in the middle of something that feels, well, honestly, it feels a little bit like we are taking a chaotic, messy garage full of rusty financial tools and finally building a precision machine.
Yeah.
We're walking through the Infinite Investor series by Jocelyn Dubé, and the feedback we've been getting has been incredible.
It really has. It feels like we are building a machine for financial survival.
Right.
And not just survival, but thriving. It's about moving from chaos to order.
Exactly. And today,
yeah.
Today is the day I think a lot of people have been waiting for.
Mm.
I want to start with a feeling that I think a lot of us have had, maybe in a video game, maybe in life if you're really lucky.
Okay.
You know that specific feeling when you've been grinding for hours, fighting low-level enemies, scraping by with low health, counting every single coin?
Oh, yeah. I think everyone knows that grind. It's the default state for most people, especially in finance. It's just constant effort.
Right. But then you find it. Maybe it's a cheat code. Maybe it's a secret room. Maybe it's that one specific item, a sword, a cloak, a relic, that just breaks the game mechanics.
Mm.
Suddenly you stop worrying about running out of ammo. You stop worrying about the little enemies because the rules just, they stopped applying to you. You're playing a different game now.
That is a very specific gamer feeling, but yes, I know exactly what you mean. In finance, we usually call that a structural advantage or an unfair moat, but cheat code is probably more accurate for what we're discussing today.
Well, today's deep dive is essentially the financial equivalent of finding a glitch in the matrix.
I like that. A glitch in the matrix.
We are looking for a specific type of asset that Dubé calls the free surfer.
Mm.
And the promise here is wild. The promise is growth that literally costs nothing.
It sounds like absolute hyperbole, doesn't it?
It really does.
Growth that costs nothing. I mean, it goes against everything we are taught in Business 101. In finance, the first rule of thermodynamics is that everything has a cost. There is no free lunch. If you want growth, you pay for it.
Right.
You pay for it in risk. You pay for it in massive capital expenditures. You pay for it in blood, sweat, tears, and anxiety. But Dubé argues that there is an anomaly, a specific rare species of company where the laws of financial physics are, well, they're suspended.
I love when we get to break physics. But before we get to the how, and before we start naming names, and we will name names,
right,
the big five specifically, we need to place this in context.
Yes.
This is episode 3 of our journey through the Infinite Investor.
Right. Context is everything here. If you just jump in here, you might think we are just picking stocks. We aren't.
No.
We are building a philosophy, a whole system. So let's do a rigorous recap to make sure everyone is on the same page.
Let's do it. Episode 1, where do we start?
Episode 1 was all about capital, specifically position sizing.
Right, sizing.
We looked at the math of loss. We learned that not all stocks are created equal, and treating them equal weighting them in your portfolio is actually a form of intellectual dishonesty.
We talked about the volatility tax. That was a big one for me.
Exactly. The volatility tax is the hidden price you pay for wild swings in your portfolio. We learned that avoiding big losses is mathematically more important than chasing big gains.
That non-ergodicity problem.
That's the one. If you lose 50% of your money, you need a 100% gain just to get back to even.
Which is brutal.
It's brutal, and it kills your compounding. So episode 1 was the don't blow up episode. It was about survival and sizing your bets based on conviction.
Okay, that was the foundation. And then episode 2, this was the one that really messed with my head. We shifted gears from money to the brain.
Attention cost. Yeah, that hit home for a lot of listeners. We realized that your brain power, your attention, is a finite resource, just like your money.
Maybe even more scarce than your money.
Probably more scarce. You can always make more money, but you can't make more time or focus.
And we talked about that 30-stock portfolio dilemma.
Right. The idea that if you have 50 stocks and 40 of them are tiny positions that don't move the needle on your wealth.
What are you doing?
You are fracturing your attention. You're paying a massive cognitive tax for zero financial benefit. You're reading 50 earnings reports, stressing about 50 CEOs, tracking 50 charts. For what?
You're essentially volunteering for anxiety.
Perfectly put. You're opting into stress for no return.
So here is where we stand now. We've optimized our money allocation to avoid ruin.
Check.
We've optimized our brain allocation to avoid burnout.
Check.
Now, the mission for episode 3 is to find the target. We are hunting for the asset that fits these new criteria. We need something that requires the least amount of attention while providing the best protection and the best growth.
We are looking for nirvana.
We are looking for the holy grail.
And Dubé calls this concept the free surfer. And to understand it, we have to grapple with a paradox. How can a business grow without spending money? Usually, if you want to sell more widgets, what do you have to do?
You have to build a factory to make more widgets. You have to hire people to sell the widgets. You have to buy ads to tell people about the widget.
Exactly. Growth is expensive. It costs capital. But the free surfer doesn't do that. The free surfer has found a way to let the world spend the money for them.
Wow.
It's a business where the growth is subsidized by everyone else.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to find this anomaly, we have to look inside a specific part of the portfolio architecture Dubé proposes. He talks about the four buckets of the infinite investor framework.
Briefly, yes. It's important to remember where this fits. Bucket one is cash. That's your safety, your optionality.
Right.
Bucket two is the index low cost, market average, can't screw it up.
Yep.
Bucket four is amplifiers, high risk, high reward, the speculative stuff.
And bucket three?
And bucket three is the engine, the compounders. Today, we are zooming in on bucket three.
This is the engine room. This is where the real wealth is made.
It is. For most investors following this framework, bucket three is roughly 40 to 60% of the portfolio. These are individual businesses with durable moats and high returns on capital.
Okay.
But here is the catch, and this is where most investors get tripped up. We tend to clump all good companies into one big group.
Right.
We say, oh, Coca-Cola is a good company and ASML is a good company, so they are the same type of investment.
But they aren't. Just because they're both good doesn't mean they work the same way.
Not at all.
That's like saying a linebacker and a gymnast are the same because they are both athletes.
Precisely. They are completely different species. Dubé argues that inside bucket three, there are distinct animals that behave according to different biological rules.
A taxonomy of compounders.
A taxonomy, and if you confuse them, you lose. You might think you're buying a racehorse, but you actually bought a plow horse.
Both are horses. Both are useful.
But if you enter the plow horse in the Kentucky Derby, you're going to have a bad time.
Okay, so let's break down the taxonomy here. He identifies three species inside this bucket. The first one is what he calls the stalwart, or the 3A.
Right. This draws on Peter Lynch's old definition from One Up on Wall Street, but Dubé refines it for the modern era.
Okay.
The stalwart is the cash now business. Think Coca-Cola, think McDonald's, think Johnson & Johnson.
It's the big, boring blue chips.
Exactly. These are mature beasts. They have massive moats, brand recognition, global distribution, supply chain dominance. They have high return on invested capital, but this is critical. They do not have explosive revenue growth.
Yeah, I think he mentions Coke grows revenue at like 3 to 5%. That's barely keeping up with inflation in some years. It's basically GDP growth.
Exactly. No one calls Coke a growth stock with a straight face.
So why is it a compounder?
This is the magic of the stalwart and why they are in the compounder bucket. They are wealth generators. Because while the revenue grows slowly, the value per share grows much faster, usually 10 to 12%.
Because of buybacks. We need to explain that mechanism briefly for anyone new.
Sure. Think of the company's profit as a pizza. Coca-Cola generates an enormous pizza of cash every year.
A huge pizza.
But they don't have anywhere to invest that cash to make the pizza bigger. I mean, everyone who wants a Coke already has one.
The market's saturated.
It's saturated. So instead of trying to bake a bigger pizza, they take that cash and they buy back shares from the market. They are removing slices from the table.
So if I own one slice and they remove three other slices, my slice represents a larger percentage of the total pizza.
Exactly. They shrink the denominator. So even if the total profit of the company isn't growing much, your share of that profit is growing every year. That is the stalwart mechanism.
Okay, so that's the stalwart. It's safe. It's reliable. It's a cash cow.
Mm-hmm.
But Dubé uses an analogy here that I thought was perfect to describe the physics of it. He says being in a stalwart is like walking on a flat floor.
Right. Picture yourself in an airport terminal. You are walking down the hallway. You are moving forward because you are walking.
I'm providing the energy.
You are. The walking represents the buybacks. If the company stops buying back shares, if you stop walking, you stop moving.
Because the ground isn't moving.
The ground underneath you isn't helping. It's just there. The market for soda isn't exploding. The market for hamburgers is saturated. You have to do the work to move forward.
Okay, so that's species one. Cash now. Walking on a flat floor. Reliable. But requires effort.
Exactly.
Then we have species two, the growth engine or the 3B.
The 3B.
This is cash later.
This is a totally different animal. Examples here would be ASML, the semiconductor equipment giant, or Copart, the salvage yard king, or even a company like Amazon in its earlier phases.
Right.
In these companies, the free cash flow isn't given back to you via buybacks. It isn't used to shrink the share count.
Where does it go?
It's plowed right back into the business. Yeah. Every single dollar is reinvested. They're building new factories. They're doing massive R&D projects. They're acquiring competitors. They are expanding into new geographies.
So the value is being created inside the business structure. They're actually making the pizza bigger.
Yes. And when it works, it is spectacular. This is where you get the 100 baggers. This is how you find the next Amazon. But here is the rub. Growth has a cost. And that cost brings risk. Dubé calls it execution risk.
Explain that. Why is spending money to grow risky? Isn't that what all businesses do?
Because you might be wrong. If ASML spends billions developing a new extreme ultraviolet lithography machine and the physics don't work out, that money is incinerated.
Gone.
It's gone. If a company builds a factory in a country that suddenly changes its regulations, wasted. If they acquire a competitor and the cultures don't mesh, disaster.
So you're betting on management.
You are betting that the management is brilliant at allocating capital. You are betting on their ability to execute difficult tasks in the real world.
So with the stalwart, you have safety but low growth and a reliance on financial engineering.
Right.
With the growth engine, you have high growth potential but high risk, high cost, and high reliance on human competence.
Exactly. It's a trade-off. It's the fundamental tension of investing. You can have safety or you can have growth. Pick one.
And this is where the setup for the free surfer comes in.
This is the moment.
Because Dubé essentially looks at this trade-off and says, I don't accept the premise.
Right. False dichotomy.
He asks the pivotal question. What if there was a business that had the safety of the stalwart, that cash now reliability, but the explosive upside of the growth engine? And what if it could do that without the cost, without the risk?
That is the definition of the free surfer. It's a unique species of compounder where the growth component is free.
Free. Okay, that's a loaded word. It makes my scam detector tingle. Let's define it rigorously. What exactly is a free surfer?
A free surfer is a business where the market expands around it due to a force that is exogenous, structural, and irreversible.
Whoa. Okay, let's break those three words down. That sounds like a textbook definition, but it's crucial.
It is. So exogenous means it comes from the outside. The company doesn't create the trend.
It happens to them.
Exactly. Structural means it's built into how the world works. It's not a fad like pet rocks or NFTs. It's a fundamental shift.
Okay.
And irreversible means it's not going back. You aren't going to wake up tomorrow and decide to stop using electricity or the internet. The arrow of time only points one way for this trend.
Okay, that makes sense. Exogenous, structural, irreversible.
Yeah.
And he uses this surfer metaphor, which I think really helps visualize the mechanics.
It's the perfect metaphor.
You've got the surfer, the board, and the waves. Let's construct the image.
Okay, first, the board. The board is the moat. The business must have a rigid, unbreakable structure that keeps it afloat.
A strong business moat.
A fortress. This is usually a duopoly, a regulatory lock-in, or a massive network effect. Without the board, you drown. You need that stability. That's the stalwart part of the equation, the safety.
Okay, so you have a solid business. That's the board. You're not going to sink.
You're not going to sink. Then you have the wave. The wave is the secular trend. It's an external force like digitalization, or the financialization of the economy, or the shift to passive investing. This force moves the water. Now think about the surfer. Does the surfer create the wave?
No. The moon and the wind create the wave. Nature creates the wave.
Does the surfer pay for the wave?
No.
The surfer simply stands there. The ocean provides the energy. In a free surfer business, the world provides the growth. The company doesn't have to spend its own capital to generate the new demand.
This is where we need examples, because it sounds abstract until you look at the big five that Dubé identifies.
Right.
He lists five companies that currently make up this free surfer club.
And notice a pattern in them immediately. Visa, MasterCard.
Okay, the payment networks.
Moody's, S&P Global.
The rating agencies.
And MSCI.
The index provider. They're all financial infrastructure.
Exactly. They are toll booths on roads that the rest of the world is frantically building. They're the gatekeepers of the global flow of money.
Let's look at Visa and MasterCard first.
Yeah.
What is the wave there?
The wave is the global shift from cash to digital payments. Dubé calls it the war on cash.
Right.
Think about it. A decade ago, how often did you use cash? Maybe 50% of the time? Today?
I honestly don't even carry a wallet half the time. I just use my phone.
Mm-hmm.
If I go to a coffee shop and they say cash only, I leave. I'm actually annoyed.
Exactly. And you are not alone. 85% of the world's transactions are still technically cash, or were recently, but that number is collapsing. Everyone is moving to card, to phone, to digital wallets.
Okay, so that's the wave. It's huge.
But here is the critical part. Who is paying for that shift?
Well, I bought my phone. The merchant bought the little square terminal. The telco built the 5G network.
Right. Visa didn't buy the terminal at the coffee shop. The bank did that. Or the merchant.
No.
Visa didn't pay for the fiber optic cables that carry the data. AT&T or Verizon did that. Visa isn't passing laws in India or Europe to ban large cash transactions to stop money laundering. Governments are doing that.
So everyone else, merchants, banks, governments, consumers, is spending billions and billions of dollars to build a digital infrastructure.
Trillions, probably.
And Visa just waits.
Visa stands there with its hand out. Every time a consumer switches from cash to card, Visa gets paid. They spent $0 to convert that user. That is free growth.
That is wild when you think about it. It's a massive global subsidy.
It is. But Dubey makes a very important distinction here in section 3 of the analysis.
Okay.
He differentiates between a cost-side subsidy and a revenue-side subsidy.
Uh-huh.
This is technical, but it explains why Visa is a free surfer and, say, UPS or FedEx is not.
Yeah, because the counterargument is, well, UPS uses public roads. They didn't pay for the highway system. The government paid for the interstate. Isn't that a subsidy?
It is a subsidy, absolutely. But it's a cost-side subsidy. The roads lower UPS's operating costs.
Okay.
They don't have to pave the highway from New York to LA. That helps their margins. However, think about growth. If UPS wants to deliver twice as many packages next year, what do they have to do?
They can't just wish for it. They have to buy more trucks. They need more tires. They have to hire more drivers. They have to pay for more gas. They have to build more massive sorting centers near airports.
Exactly. The wave of roads helps them exist, but it doesn't create free growth. Growth still requires heavy capital investment. The marginal cost of delivering one new package is high. You need a human, a truck, and fuel.
Okay, now contrast that with Visa.
Visa benefits from a revenue side subsidy. When the world goes digital, it hits Visa's revenue line directly. And here is the magic question. What is the marginal cost to Visa of processing one more transaction?
It's practically zero. It's data. It's electrons moving through a server that's already running.
It's basically nothing. A few fractions of a cent for electricity. So new revenue comes in and zero new cost is added.
That's incredible operating leverage.
It's the ultimate operating leverage. And that is the A plus B formula Dubey talks about.
Right. Let's get into the math of this A plus B. This helps visualize the P&L profit and loss statement.
So A is the base business, the toll. In Visa's case, it's the billions of transactions happening right now.
The existing cash machine.
Exactly. This generates massive cash flow today. That's the stalwart part. It's reliable. It's the cash now.
Okay. And B is the wave.
B is the growth, the digitalization. It adds volume on top for free. Now, here is where it gets really interesting. Dubey says it's not A plus B. It's A times B. It's a multiplier.
Explain that. How does it multiply? I thought it was just additive.
It feels like it should be, but it's not. Okay, so component B, free growth, feeds more cash into component A. Visa gets more revenue because of the wave.
Right, more swipes.
What does Visa do with that cash? Do they need to build factories?
No.
Do they need to buy trucks?
No.
They have no use for the cash inside the business because the growth is free. So they take that massive pile of cash and they buy back shares.
So the A component, the share count shrinking, accelerates.
Right, and because the revenue is rising naturally, thanks to B, the earnings per share go ballistic.
Okay, I see it now.
You have a shrinking denominator, shares, and an expanding numerator, earnings. And neither of them costs the company any effort.
It's a perpetual motion machine.
It's the closest thing to it in finance. It's a self-accelerating loop.
This brings us back to that escalator metaphor we touched on. We said the stalwart is walking on a flat floor.
Right. If Coke buys back shares, they are walking, they move forward. But the floor, the demand for soda, is flat.
They're creating all the motion.
All of it.
And the free surfer.
The free surfer is standing on an escalator. Even if they do nothing, even if they stop buybacks, even if management goes on vacation for a year, they rise.
Why?
Because the mechanism under them, the global economy, digitalization, is moving upward.
But they don't just stand there. That's the kicker.
No. That's the power move. That's the A times B part. The free surfer walks on the escalator.
Right.
They use the cash to buy back shares walking while the escalator moves up the secular trend.
So you're getting double the speed. You're combining the internal engine of the buyback with the external engine of the wave.
That explains the numbers. This is why Visa compounds at 15 to 18% annually, sometimes more. A standard stalwart like Coke might compound at 6 to 8%.
And yet they both look like safe companies.
They both return the same amount of cash to shareholders. They both have great moats. The difference is the escalator. One is fighting friction. The other is riding a wave.
It's such a clear image, and it really highlights why these companies are in a league of their own.
Let's talk about the others in the Big Five briefly, just to cement the concept.
Sure.
We mentioned Moody's and S&P Global.
These are the credit rating agencies. They are the duopoly that rates corporate and sovereign debt, the gatekeepers of credit.
What's the wave here?
Global debt. The world is addicted to debt.
It really is.
Governments, corporations, emerging markets, they all issue debt to fund growth or to fund deficits. And to issue debt, you need a rating. It's a regulatory requirement. You literally cannot sell a bond to a pension fund without a rating from Moody's or S&P.
It's a toll booth.
It is the definition of a toll booth. And does Moody's have to pay to get people to issue debt? Do they run ads saying, hey, America, borrow more money?
No. The economy does that. Central banks do that. Financial complexity does that. As the world gets more complex, you need more ratings. Moody's just sits there and prints the reports. Their margins are astronomical because they are selling trust, which costs nothing to manufacture once you have the reputation.
And then there is MSCI. This one is fascinating because it rides the passive investing wave.
Right. MSCI creates the indexes that ETFs track. You've heard of them. The MSCI World Index, the MSCI Emerging Markets Index.
Of course.
The wave here is the massive, irreversible shift from active mutual funds to passive investing.
Explain that shift for a second.
For decades, people paid high fees to guys in suits to pick stocks. Active management. That model is dying.
Because most of them underperform.
They do. So now trillions of dollars are flowing into ETFs that just track an index automatically for a tiny fee. Every time money flows into an ETF that tracks one of their indexes, MSCI gets a licensing fee based on the assets under management.
And does MSCI have to market the ETF?
No. BlackRock does that. Vanguard does that. State Street does that. They spend the marketing dollars. They fight the price wars. They cut their fees to almost zero.
And MSCI?
MSCI just owns the intellectual property of the index. They cash the check. It's an incredible business.
It's genius. It really is.
But I have to play devil's advocate here.
Please.
Because I'm looking at these stocks, and there is a catch. These companies aren't secrets. Everyone knows Visa is great. Everyone knows Moody's is a powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So they trade at high valuations. We're talking P.E. ratios of 30, 35, sometimes higher.
This is the big hurdle. This is where most value investors get off the bus. This is Section 5, the gratuity premium. This is where Dubé challenges how we think about expensive.
Because normally, if I see a stock at 35x earnings, I think, whoa, that's price for perfection. One slip up, one bad quarter, and I'm dead. The stock will crash 40%. Correct. And for most companies, you'd be right. Usually, high growth implies high risk.
Yeah.
If a biotech company is trading at 35x because they are launching a revolutionary new drug, you are paying a premium for that growth.
Okay.
But there is a huge risk that the drug creates side effects or the patent is challenged. That's execution risk.
Right. The risk we talked about with the 3B companies.
Exactly. So in a traditional valuation model, like a discounted cash flow, DCF, you use a discount rate to account for that risk.
Right. The higher the risk, the higher the discount rate.
High risk equals high discount rate. A high discount rate lowers the value of the future cash flows. It says a dollar 10 years from now isn't worth much because the company might be dead by then.
But Dubé argues the free surfer is different.
He says, look at the source of the growth. Does a free surfer's growth require execution? Does Visa need to invent a new payment rail next year to keep growing?
No. The world is building it for them.
Does Moody's need to invent a new type of math? No. The growth is structural. It's free.
So the risk is lower.
Significantly lower. There is no R&D to botch. There is no factory to screw up. Therefore, the discount rate should be lower.
And if you lower the discount rate in the math?
The present value of the stock skyrockets. Dubé calls this the gratuity premium. You are paying for the gratuity, the fact that the growth is free.
So his argument is that a PE of 35x for a free surfer might actually be cheaper than a PE of 20x for a capital-intensive business like a car manufacturer.
Yes, because the 35x earnings are more durable, they are harder to kill, you are paying for certainty, you are paying for the fact that the wind is at your back and you don't have to row.
It reframes the whole value conversation. It's not just about the number, it's about the quality of the earnings that make up that number.
Exactly. A dollar earned by hard labor is worth less than a dollar earned by gravity.
Wow.
Gravity is reliable, labor is not.
That's a quote for the wall right there.
Yeah.
Gravity is reliable, labor is not.
Okay, let's talk about risk management. We've talked about how great these are, but we are infinite investors. We worry about the downside.
How do these fit into a portfolio strategy? Dubey brings up Nassim Taleb and the barbell concept.
Right. This connects back to our earlier episodes about protecting yourself from ruin. The barbell strategy is the idea that you should avoid the middle.
The mushy middle.
Yeah, the dangerous middle ground. Taleb says put 90% of your money in super safe stuff cash, treasuries the shield.
Okay.
And put 10% in super risky high upside stuff options, angel investing the sword.
So you can't lose your house.
Yeah.
Shield, but you might get rich, sword.
Exactly. But Dubey argues the free surfer collapses this barbell into a single stock.
How?
It is both shield and sword at the same time.
Okay, how is it a shield?
It acts like a utility. Think about Visa. Even in a recession, people still buy groceries. They still pay bills. They still use their cards.
Is it non-discretionary?
It is. The cash flow is incredibly predictable. It protects the downside. It's the cash now component. It's resilient. It has that stalwart DNA.
And sword. How is this sword?
The sword is the unlimited upside of the secular trend. If the global economy doubles in complexity over the next 10 years, Moody's and S&P benefit disproportionately. If inflation hits, Visa's revenue goes up because they take a percentage of the transaction value.
Oh, that's a great point. It's an inflation hedge.
It's a huge inflation hedge. That's the cash later component, the explosive asymmetric upside.
So you get the defensive utility and the offensive a tech stock.
In one wrapper. And this leads to his point about anti-non-ergodicity.
Oh boy, there's that word again. Non-ergodicity. We covered this in episode one, but let's do the ELI5 version again.
Alas, it's worth repeating. Non-ergodicity essentially means the game is different if you can get knocked out.
Right.
If you lose 50% of your money, you need 100% gain just to get back to even. Big losses are sticky. They kill your long-term compounding.
And the free surfer fights this.
Ideally, yes. The A component, the cash flow, acts as a piton, you know, in mountain climbing. It's an anchor.
Right. It stops you from falling all the way down.
It prevents the catastrophic fall. But the B component, the wave, ensures the recovery happens automatically.
That's the key distinction. If I own a regular growth stock, say a biotech company, and it crashes 50% because a drug trial failed.
You need management to invent a new drug to recover. You need a miracle. You need effort. You need labor.
But if Visa drops 20% because of a market panic.
You just wait. The wave of digitalization didn't stop. The recovery is baked into the structure of the world. Management doesn't need to be geniuses. They just need to not break the machine.
That is comforting. Which brings us to sizing.
Ah, yes.
If these things are so magical, how much should we own? Dubey isn't shy here.
No, he is aggressive. He refers back to the episode one logic. Because these score high on moat, high on ROIC, high on runway, and crucially low on risk, they justify the highest allocation in the portfolio.
We're talking 5 to 12% per stock.
Yes, for a single stock. That's a high conviction bet. Most financial advisors would tell you never to go above 2%.
They'd have a heart attack.
They would. But Dubey's argument is that these stabilize the portfolio. They aren't the volatile, scary part of the portfolio. They are the bedrock. If you own the toll booth, you don't need to diversify as much as if you own the cars driving through it.
That makes sense. And this connects to the attention cost from episode two. This is my favorite part. The lifestyle implication.
This is where we transcend just making money, Dubey asks. What is the attention cost of a free surfer?
Compare it to a 3B growth engine. If I own a high-tech chip maker, say NVIDIA or AMD, I have to watch it like a hawk.
Constantly.
Is the new chip fast enough? Did the competitor just leapfrog us? Is the CEO crazy? Is China banning exports?
You're always anxious. The B growth has to be built every day. It's fragile. You have to monitor the execution.
But with the free surfer.
You only have to ask one question, maybe once a year.
What's the question?
Is the wave still there?
That's it. That's it.
Is the world still moving to digital payments?
Yes.
Obviously. Is the world still issuing debt?
Yes. Yeah, probably more than ever.
Meeting adjourned. See you next year.
Laughs. That is profound. It's funny, but it's profound because it frees up the investor. It frees up your mind.
It creates time wealth. And that is the ultimate role of the infinite investor. It's not just about having a big number in the bank account. It's about having a portfolio that serves your life rather than you serving the portfolio.
If your portfolio requires you to read 10Ks for 40 hours a week to make sure your companies aren't dying, you have a second job.
A very stressful one.
You don't have freedom. You have a highly paid, stressful hobby.
Exactly. Owning Free Surfers buys you your life back. It allows you to be lazy in the best possible way.
So let's bring this home. We've looked at the taxonomy. We've defined the Free Surfer. We've seen the math of the escalator. We've collapsed the barbell.
We have identified a structural superiority. That's what this is. It's not just a good stock pick. It's a superior business model. It's a revenue stream that grows by itself.
It protects like a utility, and it kicks like a tech stock.
That's a perfect summary.
And the challenge Dubé leaves us with, it's pretty provocative. He basically asks, why would you own anything else?
It's a fair question. If you can own a business that grows for free, why would you own one that has to work for a living?
Right.
Now, obviously, you need diversification. You need other buckets. You might want some amplifiers for fun. But the core, the heavy lifters.
They should be the ones riding the wave.
They should be the ones that don't need you.
I love that. Companies that don't need you.
It's the ultimate humility and the ultimate power. You're admitting you're not smarter than a global, irreversible trend.
So, challenge to the listener right now. Look at your portfolio. Look at your top five positions and ask yourself, how hard does this company have to work to give me my return?
Does it have to build a new factory? Does it have to invent a new product? Does it have to fight a price war? Or does it just have to stand there and collect the toll?
If the answer is they have to work really hard, maybe you need to find a surfboard.
I think that's the takeaway. Go find an escalator.
Now, we aren't done yet. This is the 34 parts. We have found the Holy Grail asset.
We have it.
We've filled our portfolio with companies that don't need our money to grow and don't need our attention to survive.
Which leads to a terrifying question.
What's that?
So, what do you do with yourself?
Right. If you don't have to stress about the stocks, if you don't have to check the ticker every 5 minutes, you're just free.
You are free. And freedom can be disorienting. If you've spent your whole life defining yourself by your hustle, by your ability to pick stocks and analyze charts, and suddenly you don't need to do that. Who are you?
That sets us up perfectly for the finale. Episode 4, The Way to the Mountain Guide.
Now that we've solved the portfolio, we have to solve the investor's life.
We have to figure out what to do with all this free time and free attention.
We have to figure out how to live with this freedom.
I can't wait for that one. This has been the deep dive into the Free Surfer. Go check out the source material by Jocelyn Dubé if you want to see the charts and the deep math. But for now,
yeah,
keep looking for those waves.
And enjoy the ride.
See you next time.